So the theme for the next three sessions with me, today, Thursday, and Friday, is unearned intimacies on the ethics of telling other people's stories. So I want to start with a question, a little preamble from me, about what an earned intimacy might be so that we can then think about what an unearned intimacy might be. So I think of earned intimacies as long friendships. You've known somebody since your freshman year of college. You're back for your 20th reunion. You've kept in touch over the years. You've earned a lot of intimacy with somebody. Pastors have earned intimacy over years. I think of it as something that has to do with length of time and depth of encounter. And then there's this odd thing that happens in journalism that I would put in the category of unearned intimacies, where a journalist enters someone's life, usually at a particularly difficult time, clergy sex abuse, the plane has just crashed. You're entering their lives to have difficult conversations about difficult topics at an emotionally vulnerable time for them. And what I think you're experiencing there is something called unearned intimacy. And a lot of the time, I think it's pretty bad. Like, I do not like being the person who has to call to confirm that some so-and-so has died. At the same time, one of the practices of journalism is to confirm things. So if the AP moves on, celebrity so-and-so has died, it is our job to not just take their word for it, but we want to confirm it before we report it. So you're often engaging in these acts of unearned intimacy. But I am not the person to create the phrase unearned intimacy. I heard it for the first time when I was a freshman at an unnamed undergraduate institution. It was in the fall of my freshman year, and I was living in Ellingson, room 123, and I really annoyed my roommate because I listened to public radio all the time. And I would wake up Saturday mornings and put on Weekend Edition, like probably many of you do. And I heard this conversation, and I've been thinking about it for 25 years this coming October. This is about a 2.5 minute excerpt, so just listen to what's happening here. Let me tell you who the speakers are. The person doing the interview is Susan Stamberg, and the person being interviewed is the photographer Richard Avedon. Okay?
You said something so interesting about your gift being not to take pictures of inanimate objects, but instead to take pictures of very animate ones indeed. Marian Anderson, a classic photograph, her hair streaming across the side of the photograph. Marilyn Monroe, the nude Nastasia Kinski wrapped in a python. Everybody who's ever looked at a poster in a college dormitory knows that photograph of yours. And you once said that a portrait photo session involves unearned intimacy. I never forgot that, and I wish you'd explain what you mean about it.
I think it's very much like what you and I are doing now. We don't know each other. You have your agenda, I have mine. You have the right to ask me anything you want. We're the same person, Susan. We use people to express ourselves. I mean, there's no question you can't ask me in the next few minutes that I won't have to respond to. The result will be the result of the two of us dealing with this unearned intimacy. I mean, if you came over to me at a party and asked me the kinds of questions you could ask me or are asking me now, I would either turn away or say, are you a anchor lady or what is this? You know, this is not a normal conversation, Susan. I don't talk about myself. You don't go around interviewing people, I hope, at dinner. You know, so what we're doing, well, you must understand me perfectly. I mean, you cannot interview the Empire State Building, but you can interview me, and we both must have this feeling about other people.
Uh-huh. But in a photography session, people can, just as they can in the interview, I can be lied to. Well, so can you.
That's right.
There at your camera.
And someone lies to me in front of my camera, I think that's interesting. I don't want to get through anything. I think a person who's lying is really interesting. Much more interesting than some bore who tells the truth.
or the fact that he or she is lying, then becomes who they are.
That's right.
In your photograph.
That's right. And that's interesting. And that doesn't mean it's the last word, and my truth isn't anybody else's truth. It's just, I guess, at bottom, in a way of expressing my feelings through them, writing my autobiography with other people's faces.
So, I play that with a bit of caution, a bit of trepidation, because Richard Avedon is not a photojournalist. Richard Avedon is a portrait artist photographer. So he says things like, I use other people to express myself. I think that would be problematic journalistically, to use other people to express yourself. He also says he doesn't really care if a person is lying to him because that becomes part of the project. Most journalists care deeply about whether they're being lied to, and we're in this sort of moment of constantly having untrue things said to us. We have a rule at NPR that we do not say that the president is lying because we cannot peer into his soul and discern his intentions. I would argue, though, that if somebody habitually lies to you over a period of time, that person, if somebody tells you untrue things knowingly over a long period of time, that person becomes a liar. So the way that I think about unearned agency in the journalistic light is similar to what Avedon says in this way. Nobody has to talk to me. Well, political people do have to talk to me, but nobody else has to talk to me. If you're an elected official, you do have to talk to me. But, you know, if say, you are doing a story about immigration and you find a family in the country unlawfully, they don't have to talk to you. You may want to talk to them, but they can always say no. And we have sort of this little rule of thumb about you can ask a couple of times, but you don't keep badgering somebody in a situation, because they are private citizens who don't have to answer to us. But if they do say yes, we're engaging in an act of unearned intimacy. Sometimes, because I work for a news organization that is thought of more highly than other news organizations, I say that we have a certain kind of corporately earned intimacy, that people trust public broadcasting, people trust NPR. They may trust Susan Stamberg to say something to her that they wouldn't say to a reporter they've never heard of. So, in some ways, the unearned intimacy of a journalistic encounter is earned by reputation. At the same time, those two people really don't have any relationship beyond the journalistic encounter. And this leads me to a question about how much of a two-way street that Avedon talks about is an interview, is a journalistic encounter. I tend to think that the subjects of interviews think that they have more control than they actually have in an interview. I also think that often the people doing the interviews, the interviewer, sometimes likes to not let the interviewee know that they can say no. I covered a lot of clergy sex abuse stories in the early aughts, and I was often asking members of congregations where children had been abused to talk to me, and I didn't preface it by, you don't have to talk to me, and it's probably not in your best interest to talk to me for all sorts of privacy reasons and pending legal action, because I really wanted them to talk to me. I also think that sometimes the subjects of interviews think that I might be on their side when I'm doing the interview, and there are lots of things that you do in a journalistic encounter to suggest to the person that you believe them or at least take them seriously. This comes up a lot in religion coverage. I covered religion for WBEZ in Chicago and for NPR for a long time, and I'm now the religion editor at NPR in addition to Western Bureau Chief. And I think that people, because you're talking to them about issues of faith and how they live their faith in the world, they feel like they can ask you the same questions you're asking them. So I might ask somebody to talk to me about their religious beliefs, and quite often when I was covering religion, not so much in clergy sex abuse, but in other areas, people would ask me what I thought of the issue. They'd say, you know, quite often the question with certain groups was, are you a Christian? And my response would be, I don't like to talk about my religious background in the same way that you wouldn't ask a political reporter who they were voting for. I'm not going to talk about my religious beliefs. Unless I thought it might help the interview, so I want to tell you a story. I was covering some iteration, I don't remember which iteration, of the Episcopal Church's gay bishop brouhaha, which is what I called it around the office. And the Episcopal priest in the Diocese of Chicago who was most outspoken about wanting Gene Robinson to not be a bishop and how he wanted to take his congregation out of the Episcopal Church in the U.S. and join it to, I believe it was the Uganda, Anglican Church in Uganda. He was really touchy about doing interviews, and then I somehow figured out that his son was a student at an unnamed undergraduate institution. I know how I figured it out, because just so clergy know, sometimes religion reporters show up as guests in your congregation. And I sat in the back, and I walked through a hall, and I saw on his door, I'm an Oli pin, and I thought, he has a connection to the college, I can use that. I can say, I went there, what's your connection to the college? And he ended up talking to me and giving me really a great interview. I was totally honest about my relationship to the school. I went there, but I used a little bit of self-revelation, a little bit of what I call selective disclosure, to say, to get him to be willing to talk to me. But I think he probably thought that it was more of a two-way street. Like, I think he probably thought that I would answer a lot more questions than I was actually willing to answer. I just, asked him what his son was majoring in and told him that I majored in religion, which was also kind of a nice thing to tell him to get him to talk to me or feel comfortable talking to me. So I think one of the things that you hear Susan and Richard doing in that snippet of a conversation, that's quite a long conversation of about 10 or 15 minutes that I just played a two-minute excerpt of. They're talking a little bit about how they understand themselves as journalists. Well, Susan as a journalist, Richard as a photographer. I want to play a piece for you now, and if anybody was in these sessions that I did last year, this next piece is the only piece that will be a repeat, so I apologize if you were here last year. But I think that I'm making a different point with this piece than I did last year, because I think it's also important to understand, for journalists telling stories, telling other people's stories, to understand how they understand their own story as a person. Now, this piece is pretty complex. It involves science, it involves literature, it involves there's an actor reading lines from a book of literature. It's a bit long, it's about 7 minutes. So, okay, this is a little weird thing about radio. Nobody sits in rooms like this and stares into the middle distance while they're listening to the radio. Tons of audience research at NPR that tells us that when listening to Morning Edition, people are doing 5 different things in 6 different locations. So they wake up, they're listening in bed, then they're in the bathroom, then they're in the kitchen, then they're in the living room, then they're in their car, then they're at work. And mostly people listen alone, or with maybe one other person in the car. All things considered, it's a little different. People listen slightly longer. You're doing 2 different things in 3 different places, or something, or 3 different things in 2 different places when you're listening to All Things Considered. So this is an artificial environment to be listening to this. Feel free to take notes.
Can we walk around?
Things you're interested in. Well, I wouldn't say just walking around. In order so that you not fall asleep, I opened all of the blinds so that there's more light in here, and I turned on all of the lights. It is a little bit warm, so hopefully you won't fall asleep during this. But I think it is delightful. It is one of my favorite pieces in public radio. I heard this just about 10 years ago on a Weekend Edition Saturday. So I'll say the first voice you're going to hear is Scott Simon from Weekend Edition, but then everything else will reveal itself throughout the piece.
This next story is about an ordinary woman with nothing very special on an ordinary day. But then, with help from science correspondent Robert Krolwich, things get more interesting.
I'm thinking
of a woman.
A charming woman, light, vivacious, though she was over 50.
Who steps out of her London home one beautiful morning to buy flowers for a party that she's throwing.
Yeah, she lives in a fancy part of London, a fancy neighborhood of London.
And, says science writer Jonah Lehrer,
Clarissa Dalloway, that's her name.
I love walking in London.
Clarissa will wend her way shopping, musing, noticing things for 200 pages and become the central character in Virginia Woolf's famous novel, Mrs. Dalloway.
What she loved was this, here, now, in front of her, the fat lady in the cab.
During which we spend much time in Clarissa's head.
Peter, he could be intolerable, he could be impossible, but adorable to walk with on a morning like this.
The novel is set in the
mid-1920s.
Yeah, and it's written not from the outside, but from inside its character.
Yeah, yeah, people like Joyce were doing this too.
Yeah, but when you're inside a Virginia Woolf character listening into a mind, what you hear...
Sylvia, Fred, Sally, see such hosts of people and dancing all night.
Is a tumble, odd thoughts past
the
faces.
Ridiculous little face, beaked like a bird. Things. Oh, that house, that ugly, rambling old
She things. Thinks about salmon, then pearls, she's happy, then she's sad.
She felt very young. And at the same time, unspeakably aged.
There's no logic to her thoughts. Instead, she's full of contradiction. Her mind scattered, barely held together, and yet somehow she does hold together. And she knows it.
I'm always here. I've got the sense of being this continuous thread.
At the beginning of the book, Clarissa steps before a mirror, her mind all noisy, but what she sees, Wolf writes, is
pointed dark-like, definite.
She's drawn herself together. That's what we all do every day. We all take this diffuse, disparate mind and draw it together, and that's who we are.
And what are the very last words of Wolf's novel?
The very last words are,
"For there she was."
And I think her novels are a search for what is that that holds me together.
But how can my mind be such chaos and still produce a coherent me?
That's the mystery.
And 80 years later, for scientists who study the brain, that's still the mystery. We have 100 billion cells in our heads, and yet...
There is no single cell in the brain that is you, or knows about you, or cares about you.
If Mrs. Dalloway's head is all random and disordered, when scientists look into the brain, same thing. There's no cell, there's no group of cells that seems to be in charge.
No, there is no center. There's no there.
And yet we have a sense that we are there, that we are a somebody. But where that sense comes from, nobody knows. In fact, today, when we look into a brain, Virginia Woolf couldn't have known this, we are anatomically divided into two separate compartments, a left brain and a right brain. So we're not just scatterbrain, they're two separate worlds in our heads. No doubt you learned this in ninth grade, so I'm going to play you a high school film narrated by Michael Gazzaniga, who with Roger Sperry did the original work in this area. Gazzaniga wondered, how divided are we? Could the two halves operate separately on their own?
Well, the way to get at this question would be to separate the two cerebral hemispheres.
Which was done to several patients who were suffering from epilepsy. Because apparently it helps stop the seizures in those people if you literally cut the connection between the two separate halves. So they did, and the patients recovered. And did they seem kind of peculiar after that? Was anything different about
it? No, actually, you know, scientists looked at these patients for many years and thought they were mostly normal.
But on closer inspection, some of them began to behave rather oddly. In one case, a patient picked up a book in his right hand and began to read, but his left hand repeatedly slammed the book shut.
So one hand would be holding the book, the other hand would be trying to close it.
In the same person?
The same person.
So the guy holding the book and one hand closing, smashing the book?
Yes.
Because the left brain, which can read, controlled the right hand, his hand opened the book, but the other side of the brain, which can't read, used its hand to close the book. As Dr. Gazzaniga put it,
and what we find out is that they fight over each other. One hand knows how to do it, and one hand does not, and so they more or less squabble.
In other cases, patients would undress with one hand unbuttoning the buttons, while the other hand would button it back up. One hand would open a door, the other slam it shut.
And these are almost mutually independent systems. It was as if two people were fighting over performing this task.
And strange as this seems, if you read Virginia Woolf's novels, she sensed this dichotomy. Her main character in the novel To the Lighthouse, Mrs. Ramsey, worships her husband one moment, dislikes him the next, finds something beautiful, then ugly, wants, doesn't want. She seems at war with herself, as Virginia Woolf writes.
Such was the complexity of things, to feel
violently two opposite things at the same time. That's what you feel was one, that's what I feel was the other. And they fought together in her mind, as now.
That's actually a very accurate description of these two separate hemispheres and the way they work.
So anyway, she felt it, and they saw it, this struggle for herself.
Yes, that in the end, they're describing the same thing. just from two different angles.
And the artist got there first?
Yes, yes. It's the artist who identifies the mystery and kind of shows us how to live with it in a sense.
And what Virginia Woolf says you write in your book is what everybody does, is they take all the contradictory things they think and feel every day, and they pull them together into a story about themselves?
Yes, and that the mind works a bit like our novelist. That we're constantly telling a narrative about ourselves to ourselves, essentially.
So what we call ourself is something we make up. It's just, we are just an invention. That's what she thought?
Yeah.
But since scientists say there's no conductor in our brain, nothing in charge, so who's the storyteller? Does Virginia Woolf know that?
No, I mean, no one knows. That's the mystery of the brain, is the story so vivid, but who's telling it?
You are listening to me right now. You know that you're there, that you are you. But how you know that, that's the central mystery of neuroscience today. And long before the scientists got into it, says John O'Leary.
I think Virginia Woolf was the first one to really identify and frame the mystery.
Robert Krulwich, NPR News, New York.
John O'Leary's essay on Mrs. Dalloway appears in his book, Proust Was a Neuroscientist. You can read an excerpt of this book at npr.org about NPR Mrs. Dalloway was Anne Bobbitt.
That is one of my favorite pieces of all time. Now, in the interest of complete transparency, Joan O'Leary was found out to be a plagiarist and making up quotes, not for this book, but for a subsequent book, oddly enough, about Bob Dylan. Like, he pretended to interview Bob Dylan. Which was a really dumb thing to do to a really brilliant journalistic career. And it's like, if you're going to make up quotes, Bob Dylan is somebody that like people will fact check something on, not like a random person on the street. I want people to know that I am not, like, you know, an acolyte of Joan O'Leary in all ways. But I think this is a really smart piece. And the reason for playing it in this session is the part of the end by who gets to tell the story, who is the storyteller. And one of the things, I do a lot of training with young journalists, and one of the things that I am constantly reminding them is that they, as the journalist, are in control of the narrative of any one piece, but they are not in control of the larger story. I mean, it is another person's story, but, and they can't change things about that story. But if you interview somebody for, say, an hour, and then you produce a 4-minute piece about them, you are leaving out a lot. You're making a lot of editorial decisions. You're making a lot of ethical decisions all along the way. That story about that thing that happened to her in childhood is super dull. I'm not going to put it in this little piece. She may have thought it was the most important thing that ever happened to her. So one of the things you have to think about during these weird encounters of unearned intimacy is to ask the person about their own reflections on the experience. So you might think it's dull, but she might think it's the most interesting thing that ever happened. And you might want to put it into the piece that here's the story that she finds very significant and help your listener understand that, maybe she's not very thoughtful because she thought that was significant and it wasn't, or help yourself by asking her, well, you know, that sounds like a really banal story. Why is it that you find it so? Well, you might not want to insult her by saying that. As I said last night, flattering people usually gets what you want out of them. So I have a couple of questions for you for most of the rest of today and the next several sessions, which, by the way, there are three discrete sessions. I'm not doing the same one over and over. I just didn't write three different descriptions for this session. I have some questions for you. How do you think about forming your own story? Do you think of it as is illustrated in this piece by Robert Krulwich, you're telling yourself a story about yourself and that story becomes true? Or maybe that was a biased way to describe it. You're telling a true story about yourself, but you're also leaving out parts and you're emphasizing other parts. Or do you think of your story as, who's the storyteller? That's, I guess, my question is, who do you think the storyteller is in your story? This was a very scientific piece describing how neuroscientists think about it. But I think that other people think of themselves more subjectively, or think of themselves less subjectively in that way. So what do you think about who is telling your story? The next question is going to be to help us start to think about how we listen to other people's stories and then how we tell their stories. And this is all going somewhere. But I want us to think about how we tell our own stories.
I have about 10 things I'd like to say, but I'll just say one. Stories change as people, I mean, say something that happened 400 or 500 years ago. What we believe now and think and has been told to us may not be anywhere close to what really, really happened. For example, Joan of Arc, Jeanne d'Arc, was executed by fire by the English. They took control of a town. And about 30 years later, the French retook the town. And they had access to the records that the English had taken. And it was just a made-up job. It was completely falsified. She wore short hair. She wouldn't wear women's clothes. And you see how whatever story prevailed was who's in charge. So I just wonder if you suffer from that. You know, people want to present a good image of themselves. You know, what happened when they're young, how they were brought up, and
well, I think this goes back to the conversation that you heard at the beginning with Richard Avedon. You have to figure out if people are reliable. I think that we imagine that people's memories are like video cameras, but they're not. We don't actually remember in the way the film works. What we do is we have an experience and then we tell ourselves something about that experience that reminds us of that experience, and we keep telling ourselves that story over and over again until it becomes true. This actually reminds me of something that was said to me in a pastoral care class I took at, we named the Divinity Store, a terrible pastoral care class in which I was told to fake it till I felt it. I've actually used that in journalism, but I don't know that it should work in pastoral care, but like pretend to be interested in something to get the person to keep talking to you. But as soon as you start asking questions, as soon as you start writing down the story, you're not recording it the way that your mind recorded it, which is not narratively, but by sort of disparate moments that you're organizing into a story. Does that sort of get it? I mean, it's also like as I don't know.
You're
there were such things as journalists.
Creating your own version of
right.
it in a
I
way.
Mean, in the time of Joan of Arc, I don't think there were such things as journalists. So there wasn't anybody trying to write down a fair-minded account. There were victors writing histories. But I do think it is important to think about who is in power in the relationship. There's a wonderful book, I didn't recommend this on the list that's in the library, but there's a wonderful book by Janet Malcolm called The Journalist and the Murderer. And it has this incredibly devastating opening paragraph, which is about how basically journalists help people believe that they are more intimate with them than they really are, so that the subject of the interview will tell you more, and in the end, every subject of a piece of journalistic writing feels in some way betrayed. Now, maybe you think you got the story right, but you left out that one part that I really liked. Or maybe you think you got the story all wrong. But, I mean, I personally do not, I always tell relatives of mine, do not participate in pieces of journalism. You don't have to. I mean, if you're an elected official, you have to, but you don't have to if you're just a private citizen. I always tell my husband, do not go on Nightline if I'm hijacked by terrorists. I really don't want, like, the world to know. It's actually, when New York Times journalists and Washington Post journalists have been kidnapped while they're on assignment in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, they work very hard to not report the story, in part because they don't want to become a story, but also they know that the chances of, like, one of the goals is publicity, and so not doing publicity is in case any of you is ever kidnapped.
I'm really influenced by something I heard, that when somebody's testifying at a trial, the more certain they are of what they saw, the less likely it is that it's true. That the people who are not quite sure of what they remember are more likely to get the facts right.
I just sat on a 9-week attempted murder trial, and I will say that it was the witnesses who said, I'm pretty sure, and the ones who said, well, I couldn't see everything, but this is what I think I saw, I took much more seriously than the ones who very specifically was like, I saw him do it. There's all sorts of interesting eyewitness testimonies. The psychology of eyewitness testimony is very interesting, and how it affects juries. I don't actually think that people should be convicted on eyewitness testimony alone.
But it makes me think that when you're telling your own story, the more certain you are about your own history, the less likely that part of your history is accurate.
I mean, there are whole movements of like writing workshops where you're asked to write your story with you as the hero, then you as the victim, then you as a bystander to your story, that helps you think about the various perspectives that you might have. And I think that certain therapeutic models also ask people to think of themselves as different characters within their own story, or playing different roles within their own story. Maybe the main character, but maybe a different kind of main character. Yes?
I'd love to be a sponsor of that. I can't say about telling my story, but my story being written is kind of the same thing. And I feel like I'm not writing my own story. And the context of that is that if I think about some of the most life-changing decisions that I've made are the ones that I spent this time working on. And conversely, the ones I agonize over during, it wasn't important.
I personally tend to think it's a combination of the two. I mean, it's basically like a giant creative writing workshop that we're all engaged in, and we're telling our stories, and other people are telling stories, and their stories are affecting our stories. And we're also telling different stories about ourselves to ourselves all the time based on what other people are saying. So I tend to think it's both.
That's a peptide for the identity testimony and maturity, but my first thought was that the narrative I tell depends on who I think is listening. And whether I want them to think a certain way about me. And it could be that I want this person to admire me for being someone with conviction that I can get the value, and so then I want to portray that. Or I want someone to be sympathetic to me because I need some sort of affirmation, or that not that the story does change. The editing of the story changes depending on the circumstances.
Now, I think you used the word you find yourself in it. You're doing it and then you notice you're doing it, or do you go into situations thinking, this is the story I'm going to tell when I'm at Holden versus the story I'm going to tell when I am at the office?
I may have used that language because now I'm reflecting on it and going, okay, so how do I do this? And I go, I certainly edit differently depending who I'm talking to. So I maybe, when I've been telling stories, didn't really think about it that way, but as I look back on it, even just the conversations I've had here, I'm like, oh yeah, I didn't tell the same details about the same story I told to people.
And you know, we live in a world where if somebody gives you different details at different points, we may suggest, like, are you not telling the truth? Which was true then or now?
Right.
But it might just be that I didn't tell you everything the first time, I didn't tell you everything the second time. I was telling you different parts of the story based on the audience. Like, you might tell the same story differently to a colleague that you barely know versus to a close friend versus to a pastor versus to your child.
Well, and then the storytelling gets better. I think, oh, I get a laugh if I told it this way.
Yeah.
You know, like this funny piece, like that sort of rambled, so I'm going to cut that short.
So this, I do this with my husband all the time on our way to parties. I'm always saying, like, what's your cocktail chatter going to be? Because he's very shy, and he is always very nervous and will, like, literally take out his Kindle and start reading at a party. So I have to, like, count him, but, like, you should tell the story of X going on. Like, you should tell the story of Y with our dog's healthcare situation. Well, don't get that.
I'm not sure who tells my story, but I think from an anthropological point of view, and I'm reading anthology right now, so it's in my head, so this story that I'm telling right this minute is good, I'm reading that book. But I'm both a participant and an observer, And because I'm doing both of those roles, what I'm participating in right now might be the story I tell you about myself. It might influence all the other episodes, and that might be what comes out. Right? If I am more in an observer mode, then I might look upon all those episodes very differently. And also, I think, at least personally, I'm always being formed. I have no idea who I am. I really don't. I mean, I know who I am in a moment. I know who I kind of do. I don't really know. And I think that I will know different things tomorrow than I know today. And in some ways, you know, whoever I present to the world, I hope that it's a decent person and that other people love it. She'd be cool. I'd like to hang out with her. I mean, that's probably as far as, and it's not that I haven't thought about it, it's that it's constantly changing.
Well, the story is constantly being written. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're still living your story. It's not like somebody's story is over 100 years ago and you can research it. It's, you could change, what is right now the highlight and climax of your life might not be 5 years from now.
Absolutely,
One more question, and then I want to play one more piece, which is a bit, which is pretty long. It's about 12 minutes long. It's a little more artistic than these other pieces, which were a bit more sort of narrative.
I can't help but think about the relation of this conversation and the conversations going on nationally about separation of children from their parents who are migrants, and how frequently on social media you'll see people say, this isn't us. And like that America is not one that would separate children from parents, and yet it's core to our identity. Like we did it with slavery in the beginning, Japanese internment was another time where we forcibly removed people from the community and things like that. So I'm wondering about, like, when we say this isn't us, even though it's not true, is that grounded in like who we need to think of ourselves as?
I think it's who we'd like, how we'd like the story to be written about us. Yeah. I actually got disinvited to a wedding recently because I wrote about this issue on Facebook. I think this is precisely who we are. This is who we've always been. And they were very upset with me. Suddenly it was fine. I'd already sent the gifts. So I'm going to play this piece. Let me give you a little bit of background. I don't like to tell you what the story is about. The story should reveal itself, but I want to give you a background on this is part of something called the Lost and Found Sound Sonic Memorial Project. After the destruction of the World Trade Centers, NPR spent a year finding and recording stories of the trade centers and how they were built and who worked there and people who did art related to the World Trade Centers. So this is a piece from that series. This aired in 2002 in the days leading up to the one-year anniversary of 9/11. I apologize for the audio is going to sound a little bit tinny. On Thursday of last week, I asked my intern to pull a more high-quality version of this, but then the Annapolis shooting happened, and everybody went into high dungeon news breaking news mode. So this is an older recording that I pulled off the web, so the sound quality is not what I would say quite up to my standards, but you can still understand it. It sounds pretty good.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Time for another story from our Lost and Found Sound Sonic Memorial Project.
My name is Lynn Boga, and I come from Gunawaga, a Mohawk community across the St. Lawrence from Montreal. I remember back in the early 60s, my grandfather, he would come home from New York for 4th of July weekend. That's where all the Mohawk iron workers gathered.
Since September, hundreds of you have called our Sonic Memorial phone line with your sound and stories, chronicling the history of the World Trade Center.
I remember my grandfather telling these younger iron workers that there would be a big job coming up, that New York City would be taking on the construction of the world's tallest building.
For over 100 years, Mohawk iron workers have helped shape Manhattan's skyline. The Twin Towers, the Chrysler Building, the Empire State. The Mohawk ironworking tradition began in the 1880s in Canada, when men from the reservation helped work on a bridge being built across the St. Lawrence River to Montreal. The Mohawk showed a skill and fearlessness on the narrow, high steel spans. Six generations later, some 500 of them would help construct the twin skyscrapers that were then the tallest buildings in the world. Producer Jamie York gathered sound and stories at the two Mohawk reservations that straddle the New York-Quebec border. With the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davian Nelson, he prepared this story about Walking High Steel.
It's 3 right now outside our studios. That's the way it's going to be for the next couple of days or so. Don't forget Radio Bingo tonight.
The Twin Towers, the twins. The Nick, that's more. I'm a bird plan, huh? We go plan. Bill O'Hara Oaks, from Upper Dust. Yeah, when I worked in the World Trade Center, that was the year of 69. I was working up in New Jersey. You can see it from there, the tower was going up. They told me it's going to go up to 110 floors, huh? I said, I want to get on that building.
Saturday night, 8 o'clock. They're going to want a Mohawk senior lacrosse team to get back in action once again.
Walter Wilma, and they got along in the Indian Reserve. 99% of the reservation are Irish. My brother was. Yeah, my whole family was at one time. One of the elders takes you under their wing. You got to learn how to crawl before you can walk.
My name is Pete LaFleur, and I worked in the World Trade Center in 1969 and 70. I was a connector of steel. My mother's brother was a great ironworker. My grandfather worked on the Empire State Building. He worked in Brazil, he worked in France, San Francisco Bay Bridge. Weekends when they came home, he sat around with the family, and that's all they all talked about. It's all you heard, all your life. When you started working yourself, you could almost do the job because you were talking so much about it when you were a kid.
My name is Randy Horn. I've been an iron worker for 33 years. The Trade Center was the most time I ever spent with my father, one-on-one. I never really knew him. He was always away providing for his family. I learned to know him on the job. My father put me in the gang, start bolting up right away.
I was on the North Tower. North Tower started first. I was a pusher, a foreman. It's like a band leader. What pieces go where, A, B, C, and so forth. Don't forget, I was on that job about 10 years, and I came back and put up the antenna. I had my son with me, and it was one of his first jobs. And up about 3/4 of the way up the antenna is a catwalk. So I got my son over there. Everything was all right. Everything was fine. All of a sudden, the damn fog went. And now he's looking down and he sees cars about this big. I know one thing, that building had a good windy day. When you come out that thing, you feel like a drunken sailor.
The height didn't even bother me at the time. I could go 120 at the time. You think twice now when you're walking on the steel. Walking on the steel with the wind, if you get some gusts, it could throw you right off. Okay, now all of a sudden the wind picks up and you just try to balance yourself. You would have to jump from the top of the beam and into the bottom of the beam and grab the top and hold on. They call it cone. You got to cone it. All of a sudden the wind gets you and you jump and you crouch down and grab the flanges of the beam so you won't fall off. And when the wind dies down, you get back up and keep going.
That was daring, and that's a daring job. Because when you're walking a girder, the wind is blowing, say, from the north. Now you're leaning into it. All of a sudden, the wind stops you and keep on going. Could you imagine?
You're in new space in New York City. You're kind of in this air that nobody's ever been there before.
On the B Tower, we were losing time, $50 extra a week, just to stay up there. We have to bring our own sandwiches. We used to carry our own tents with us, lean-tos, whatever we needed, and our own heaters in the winter.
My name is Brett Bonaparte. I'm an iron worker working in Manhattan. It's just like a ballet. We've got these two guys on the bottom. The rig comes down, they put the chokers on, boom, the piece goes up. They spin it just the right way through the air. One guy catches and he swings the other end into you and you spud your end. Me and Andy work together a lot. We know each other's thinking and even living together. But we don't see each other on weekends, thank God. Friday afternoon at work.
Adios.
See you Sunday.
Hey,
I'm 103.7 FM.
My name is Rosie. I have 5 children. I married into an ironworker family. Out of the 42 years, we lived together as husband and wife for only 10. The rest of the time, was always gone.
Economics. Drives guys to do it. It's the best paying of all the trades. You know, it's been our culture for 120-some years. During wars, during hunting and trapping, there's always times when men left. The women were the ones taking care of the community. They always have, and they still do.
Ironworkers are hopeless for doing things around the house, taking care of the bills, taking care of the kids, making the car payments. My husband never didn't even know how to write a check because he was never here to do it. I took care of everything.
If there was work here, you take it. My name is Peter Stacy. You don't want to leave your family. Everything that goes with home. You're sleeping in your own bed, getting to cut your grass, your friends, sit on your porch, relax, go up to the quarry, go for a swim. You drive down the road, people smile and say, hello, hello. It's home.
In this house on Sunday, I generally cook. I'll make something that the boys will like this week, and I'll make them cornbread and steak. And they'll eat, and then they'll go to sleep around 7 o'clock. I kiss him goodbye when he goes down, and then he'll wake up around midnight. I don't even notice, and he's gone.
A lot of times it's really quiet in the car. I know how I am on Sunday afternoon. You get lonesome before you even leave. Sometimes you're home and you just have a fight because it's hard, you're leaving again. These are the same arguments that have been going on for generations. My mother, my father, my grandparents, they all had the same problems. You know, the guys are leaving on Sunday night. And they won't be back till Friday night.
It's a 5-hour drive. When you travel with other guys, there's 4 of you in the car. Coming home on a Friday is enjoyable. The stories are good all the way home. When you're going back Sunday night at midnight, you guys get in the car and you go to sleep, and that's it. And you wake up in Brooklyn.
When we get off the subway in Brooklyn on Atlantic Avenue, there's about 4 bars you can go to as you're walking to where you live.
You got Harlem, then you got Little Italy, then you have Brooklyn. State and Nevins, there's about a 46 block square area, all the state there. About every fourth door that you walk by is going to be somebody from Colorado. Country boys, eh? You get them in the big city there, they hit.
There was 200 ironworkers from Colorado in New York City, working on different jobs. Every night when you finish work, everybody met at different bars for a couple of beers and talked about their job, and everybody wanted to be the best gang in New York City. There's none of the Native people here ever wanted to finish second.
Some jobs that were on was all Mohawk, so everybody spoke Mohawk. Okay, it's nice to hear the old timers talk and they're laughing. You know, myself, I don't speak it too good. Everybody was so worried about the white society. You know, they would talk English all the time. After a while, you know. One day if the government will come up to you and say, nobody speaks Mohawk no more, you're not Indians no more. That's what my mother told me.
My name is Kyle Bove, and I've been an ironworker for 21 years. When I talk to people that aren't ironworkers, and you tell them you're Indian or Mohawk, and they say, oh, you're Mohawks, you're the people that aren't afraid of heights. When I go up, I'm afraid of falling, but it's just that we deal with the height better.
If a man falls to his death, you leave the job for the day, more often than not, you go sit in a bar and everybody's very quiet, you have a couple of beers, nobody jokes around, there's no laughing. The next day, you go to work, everybody's overcautious. It wasn't your time to go, but brings back a very harsh reality of ironwork.
As you come into the eastern side of the community, there's a steel cross there that they put up for the memory of the men that fell on the Quebec Bridge. 1907. The men were all working there when it fell. 33 men from the community lost their lives. The women got together and told the men that they never want a large group of men to work together on the same job in case a disaster happens like that again. But the men do it today anyway.
K103,
you got the lock. Okay, so when I was in the house, I got 8 after 9 o'clock.
Dave LaHash is the news. He's got some very big information for you.
Two planes have crashed into the World Trade Towers. We do have some Gunawaga Jornal in New York. We're going to be trying to get in touch with them as soon as possible. Of course, they're working the iron up there. Please give us a call here at the radio station, 638-1313.
We've got about 10 rigs here, maybe 200 iron workers right now. It's still on fire right now.
The first day I walked into Ground Zero, it was such an emotional event for all of us iron workers to go on together.
Fire engines all over the place, all the buildings are all smashed all the way around.
Mountains and mountains of twisted iron and steel everywhere. So unpredictable. You know, you have to get this piece out of the way so the firemen can come underneath and do their job.
When I seen that antenna go down on the North Tower, my heart just sank for it. I worked on that building, and I explained to my son that I was done there, and I don't know, just the emptiness when it went down.
When we found it, we were pulling these other pieces of iron off, and it looked like, wow, what is that? It looks like a rocket. It was the antenna. When I finally did get to go home after working out, I was, you know, I had a pregnant woman, had a beautiful baby. Her name is Yananawi. Yananawi means she guards the corn, and it's a clan name. She's the only one with it, and she's growing leaps and bounds. So that's a good thing to see that life. Yo-yo, hey, yo-yo, hey. Before I went home on the weekend when I got time off, you just wash with tobacco water and cleanse yourself. We probably all have parts of, you know, all those people inside of our systems. I think that's part of everybody's responsibility that I was there, is that we all carry some of those people in us.
Our story of Walking High Steel was produced for the Sonic Memorial Project by Jamie York and the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, and mixed by Jim McKee. The Sonic Memorial is a collaboration between Lost and Found Sound, NPR News, WNYC in New York City, and independent producers nationwide. For more Mohawk stories and images, visit NPR.org. This is All Things Considered.
This is a story that, in the business, we refer to as a non-narrated story, meaning there isn't a reporter whose voice threads throughout the piece, tying the story together. It's more like a narrative collage. You're hearing, I think I counted once, there are eight characters who tell their story in that piece. The idea being that you might get a different sort of picture if you're hearing it entirely told from the voices of the people who experienced it. However, so here's my question for you. There isn't a right or wrong answer. I have my ideas about it. Who is the storyteller in that story?
Editor.
Well, that's what I think. Yes. You know, the people who they announced produced it beforehand. They you know, did hours and hours and hours of interviews with people and then shaped it into a story. Maybe somebody told them what happened on the day of 9/11 first, but they put it at the end for a good reason. But if you think of the idea, right in the middle of that story about the World Trade Center going down, after we learn that there were 200 people working around it on the day that it happened, and before you learn that they inhaled a lot of the remains of people, there's that weird little birth story in the middle there, and I never know what to make of that. What do you make of that story?
I think the hope of life going on.
Yeah. I think so too, but I don't know why it's where it is. I would have put it at the end. When he got home, he saw his daughter. Not, I went home and saw my daughter, and then I realized I'd inhaled the lives of all these other people. But, I mean, that's an editorial. That's an editing decision to be made. I love the idea, by the way, of inhaling the lives of other people, as gross as that might seem.
If it was a visual collage, that story at the center would make more sense, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Highest expression.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I have tried to outline this piece. I can't figure it out. Someday I will find Jamie York and ask him what the structure was.
I think it's extremely hard to do because you have to reorient yourself to different voices all the time. Right. Extremely hard.
Yeah, this is one of those pieces that I don't know that would air today. It's about 12 minutes long, and a non-narrated 12-minute piece. Sadly, that's not exactly where we are in the world of broadcast, but it might be something that could work in podcasts where people can back up, can pause it. If they're not paying attention, they can re-listen to the whole thing. So I, as much as I like this piece, I worry that like in the media environment where it wouldn't work today. So here's a question that, this is sort of an ethics question, and I think it's where I want to lead this conversation. I have some ethical qualms with this story because I think I'm a little concerned about what the producers may have been doing is saying there is one character in this story, and that character is the Okanagan, or is the Okanagan Reservation Indians, rather than individual stories. But I think there's a push and pull with that. You do hear individuals' stories, but there is no one main character in the story. So I worry that by diffusing the narrative with eight different characters, they want to say a Mohawk ironworker is one thing, and we're going to give you a bunch of views on that one thing. I personally, when I produce stories, as you're going to hear in some stories that I've edited myself, I tend to like one strong main character who undergoes something rather than pieces like this. Although I do like listening to pieces like this, I live in this constant fear of like 25 hours of tape that I have to cut down to 12 minutes. And that's what something like this would involve. You know, each person, you're spending hours and hours talking to them, and then you're pulling the best few minutes of it to turn it into 12 minutes.
I just wanted to comment that I think if I were the editor, I would have ended as the editor did because of the sound of that song. That to me would have been an ideal ender on it, and therefore I would have probably maneuvered to let that be given.
You mean, would you move that something
the
else
up? Story, the first story could go forward then, perhaps. I think that the song he's singing as he's alluding is really powerful.
Maybe one or two more comments on the good one, or
David? One of the storytellers that I sense in a piece like this is the listener actually becomes the storyteller, right? And so, I mean, yes, the editor puts in all the work, but the people putting together the pieces and making sense of how these disparate pieces are going to be shaped into a narrative are the listeners without a narrator, right? And so, so to your point about the ethics of this, especially with a community like this community on the reservation, by playing on this idea that it's this one story, not the story of many, many people, you're actually playing on probably a lot of the biases that are happening internally with the storyteller, especially if the audience is not of that community, right? And the bias is, oh, they're all the same. So it's actually, then the storyteller reinforces a bias, right?
The storyteller being both the producer and the listener.
Yeah, yeah.
It's sort of a collaboration between the two. Like meaning is like reading the Bible. It's like meaning happens in the encounter, not in the text over here and in the person over here, but when the two come together. The other reason that I do sometimes find these non-narrated pieces problematic is that listeners sometimes think, oh, this is all just their own words and this hasn't been manipulated or edited in any way. When it has been so, I have to say, as someone who does this, this is way harder than writing with a narrator. When the reporter can like impose the narrative line, there's a, Joan Didion talks about this in, I think it's the White Album. She talks about how what writers do is impose a narrative line on what she calls like the phantasmagoria of existence. So she says, what journalism is to impose the narrative. There's a huge imposition of narrative here, but I worry that when you don't have a narrator in a piece, or when you don't have a reportorial voice in the piece, that people think that they're hearing a more pure version of the story when it is just as much, if not more, created by the producers.
Yeah.
Can we get time for one more?
Well, I was thinking of it in a little different way that you used the word, that it was a story of a community, really. And so these individuals were sharing pieces of their story, and they were, as you said, highly edited. But it created this, a story of a community that was, the role of the women, the role of men, relationships of fathers and sons who didn't know each other until they worked together. So
the community itself becomes a character.
For me, that was the strongest character in the story. Was the story of the community that emerged.
I totally understand that. I think that is a great understanding. I'm always a little nervous about community. A lot of white people went into making that story, and so
it is
white producers' views of what that community is.
And I didn't know they were all white, I know race is such a tricky thing, but it doesn't mean that there has to be bias that makes it does terrible things to a story either. Sensitive.
So Germaine,
what
Christine is saying is that in the 90s, the value, community as a value, was highly elevated, and after 9/11, a national identity thing seemed to have happened, and then identity seems to have come out of that as an elevated value. I was on Akwesasne shortly after 9/11, where that was done, where they have been the center of Native American communities from all around the country doing a particular thing. And there was a real strong, they have had a really strong community value thing being narrated on Akwesasne.
I did a story about the Akwesasne just this past fall, about these young women in the schools who created a Native pride group because they were sick of being made fun of. And so they have like a Native pride week, and they do all the things that like LGBT people do during pride week for pride. Then we'll close here because I want to
just a quick question, not exactly in line with this story, but how consciously does the editor use the music to influence how you hear it?
Very consciously. I mean, it's all put in. Like there wasn't sort of natural music underneath any of those people. Yeah. It's all inserted. I mean, Jamie York and the Kitchen Sisters tend to do a lot of sort of mood creation through music. I mean, I think it's really clear what they're doing here. They're playing music from the Akwesasne radio station.
Yeah.
And so you're hearing, and it might not be clear at the very beginning, and I like that. I like that the use of the music emerges as, oh, we're hearing a radio station.
Uh-huh.
And then we really understand that what we've been hearing is a radio station telling this community the news.
Yeah.
When we hear the 9/11 story, everything is constructed in this piece. Some people refer to it as like there's a lot of artifice. There's also a lot of artifice in writing a journalistic newspaper piece. Like, you talk to people all day, you spend 6 hours recording a story and 2 hours writing a story. You're doing a lot of condensation. You're controlling the narrative. I like the idea that the narrative emerges in the conversation between the people talking and the reporter doing the storytelling, but I also know exactly how much power the producers and reporters have in the story. And so I hope that it's clear in this, but it is always a concern of mine that sometimes people think this is a pure story because there was no narrator. There's really a very strong narrator in this piece. And part of the manipulation is for you to not hear that there is a narrative there. But yeah, the use of music is, it's all inserted later. Well, thank you for coming today.